nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Good afternoon, everyone. It is a great pleasure to introduce our speaker today, Professor Daniel Neuhauser from the Department of Chemistry at UCLA. Professor Neuhauser did his undergraduate thesis in the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, and then also his PhD in physics at Caltech. And then he saw the light and started to see that electrons really are entities that undergo chemical, responsible for chemical reactions. So he decided that chemistry is the place to be. So he did the two postdocs, one in principle with Eric Ravitz and one in Chicago with John Light. And then in 1992, he joined the faculty at UCLA. He has made many very important contributions in the theoretical development of quantum mechanics in general. And today, title of the talk is...
I changed the title. It's okay. So, thank you so much. First, I would like to thank Sabri and Igal for the invitation. And what I will talk about will be the whole... basically, there is a shrinking gap that in our treatment of molecules and radiation. The old way of looking was that we have radiation, which is actually quite big. Photon size is about 1 micron, and molecular size is a few angstrom. Nowadays, it starts changing. The hope that we have is to eventually treat molecules and the radiation on equal footing, solve the Maxwell-Schrödinger equation together. There are several technical details need to be worked out and several new concepts that you learn. So I'll talk about those. We are not exactly at where we want to be of solving them all together, but we are very close to it, and hopefully in a year or two we will be there. So let's see what we learn along the way. Well, the first new conceptual development that came the last few years, but really has been almost 20 years now, is the concepts of near field. Those are strong, short-range electromagnetic fields. They have optical frequency, but they change on a very small length scale. So if this is a molecule, you have radiation which goes as 1 over r cubed. So it falls off very fast compared to far-field radiation, which goes like 1 over r. But... it is stronger because far-field radiation is 1 over c squared over c, the velocity of light, which is quite a big quantity. So you have new phenomena associated with this near fields. Other things which happen is that you start looking at bigger molecules, essentially dots, quantum dots. You start looking at the interaction between quantum dots. Then you get to the point where you start asking yourself, how are the molecules or dots affecting the field? And you ask yourself, when we talk about near fields, what kind of spectroscopy? Can we get nonlinear spectroscopy? Can you use a microscopy? So this is the physical background. And many of you have seen the pictures here. Physical realization of near fields, one of the nicest realizations is plasmonics, which is basically transport of electromagnetic energy on a nanometer scale. And the nicest way to do it is with quantum dot arrays. So if you look at the scale here, we are talking about 2 micron. So each of the dots here is much smaller on the scales of tens or hundreds of nanometers. And you see that if we shine light here, for example, we light up this whole array of dots. And another way on a similar scale would be that you shine light here, essentially, and it comes all the way up to here, and you see how you can guide light as if it was a regular electron or a regular particle. Another application that people are very interested in nowadays is nanorulers. So you take two quantum dots, typically of gold or silver. Typical distance would be 20 nanometers, but it can range from a few nanometers to 100 nanometers. And you look at what the absorption color. And the absorption color changes with the distance because of the coupling between the dots. And this is a way of measuring distance. People look in biological, in cells, basically, they hope to use that. So the first direction that we looked at is essentially from the bottoms up to try to understand how to simulate behavior of molecules or dots when we get to such large distances, say, of tens of nanometer or few nanometer, which are very large compared to typical molecular distances. So the first question we... First approach we try to use is the most natural one for studying interaction between objects, and it is a TDDFT, which stands for time-dependent density functional theory. Now, without getting into too much details, the idea in TDDFT is very simple, that each electron responds to the electric field also magnetic field that created both externally, and it created by the overall electron distribution, in other words, by the overall density. In other words, each electron interacts with the density created by all electrons. This sounds very natural, but before I get to the main part of the talk, I want to describe to you for 5 minutes what's the problem and how did we solve them. To see the problem in this context, we have to describe what it is first and then see manifestation. The problem is a so-called self-energy, that because the electron interacts with all the other electrons, a density created by all the other electrons, part of the density is its own density. In other words, in DFT or TDDFT, an electron interacts with itself. This is unlike Hartree-Fock, where Hartree-Fock, the exchange cancels the interaction of the electron with itself. And this is, of course, unphysical. Physical electron does not interact with itself. Now, that leads, when you try to couple two spheres together, let's call one of them A and its charge A plus, the other one B. The system we have, the excitation of one of them was at 3 electron volt, 3 point something. The other one was at 4 electron volt. So when you take two systems and you put them far away, a few nanometer away, you expect that basically the combined system, if you are far enough, should have essentially an overlying of this spectra together. And that's not what happens. No matter what distance you put it in, beyond a certain distance, it stabilizes. So there will be a blue shift of this by 0.3 electron volt, and this peak is redshifted by 0.1 electron volt. And the reason is exactly this self-energy problem. So we set up to solve it, and we found it actually there is a very simple solution. The approach is like this. You divide the electron-electron repulsion, the 1 over R, to two parts. One part is short range, another part is only long range. And you treat them differently. You treat the long range, you put an exact exchange. The short range, you put a local DFT. This approach, we then found out, was actually suggested by a Japanese group in 2001, but we were actually able to prove that this approach is an exact. So we give you the exact results for a value of gamma, which is unknown. We don't know what it is, but we know that there is a value of gamma, which is where you get the exact results. And it turns out numerically that the results are not overly sensitive to the value of gamma, so you can make a reasonable choice of gamma being about one inverse atomic unit and get fairly good stable results. This is just a very simple slide. I'm not going to go through it, but I just want you to appreciate that there is a little bit of theory involved there, but it's really quite simple. That's all you need to do. It looks formidable, but it isn't. More importantly are the results. Well, this solves many self-energy problems. So this allows us at once to get to problems where there was a polarizability issue in big system or problems of electron transfer. For example, let's say that we have a chain of hydrogen molecules, a very simple problem that is notoriously problematic in DFT, because in DFT, the polarizability of such a chain, this polarizability is a function of the number of oligomers in the chain, grows, and it grows linearly. And it doesn't seem to stop to grow. Now, that's not what physically happened. Hartree-Fock gives the physical results that this polarizability should level off. And our approach, which I say gamma equal 1, our approach gives the correct values. More exciting would be that you can get Coulomb blockade suddenly with this approach. Take two such spheres. A moment ago we said we are going to couple them with absorption, but let's just use a DC field instead. So we subject these two spheres to a DC field. Now we know what physically will happen. If they are far away, basically nothing will happen. There will be no electron transfer until the voltage difference is equal to the difference between the ionization energy and the electron affinity. And then immediately an electron will transfer. This is a simple thing that we know all from freshman chemistry. Regular DFT does not give this. When you plot the excess charge on one of the spheres as a function of the voltage, you get continuous curve. But when we use our approach, we get the Coulomb step. Basically, no transfer of voltage and suddenly a transfer. So with this, we are able also to get excited state energy, Rydberg states, very accurately also. Question?
How much is the broadening of this Coulomb peak?
The broadening has to do with how close you are, which is physical. I think here the broadening is artificial simply because we didn't use a very narrow, we didn't check at many points. But in practice, it will have to be, it has to do with the tunneling rate, and if they have basically it will be very small. That's what you expect in practice. And we get the result which are the broadening which we would expect because essentially this is such a long distance, so only the long range part which is treated exactly is involved.
I'm just curious because for the distances you're talking about, this broadening seems quite large.
You're saying this broadening or this one? This one, yeah, but it's not a real broadening. It's just the computer connected the two dots. So if we, this is 0.1 electron volt. So I'm sure if we had a finer grid, we would get.
White dots are calculations.
The white dots are calculations. I'm sorry, and the orange are just continuation by, I mean, basically graphed by the computer. I'm sorry. Using this approach, we can now study the coupling of two such spheres at short distances. Now, these are shorter than distances that they employ in nanorulers. At this distance, there should be a little bit of electron tunneling. Not much, but interestingly, you get very nice peaks dependent on distance. So we are talking about 20 atomic units, which is about a little bit more than 1 nanometer. And when we vary by 1, 20, 21, 23, and 24, you see the peaks change. There is a peak, not only change, but there is a peak, peak go back and forth. So this peak becomes a 20 atomic units, and at 24, they're in the similar size, but at 21, you have a resonance. So this peak essentially shifts and then comes back. So you get interesting behavior, which may be translated to something experimentally useful. And this tells you that you can actually measure that if you are able to experimentally reproduce it, you'll be able to get very accurate gauge distance dependence on a sub-angstrom level with this measurement.
So those peaks are in the UV, but what happened to the visible resonance that should be the plasma resonance? Is that not in this calculation?
Well, what happened is we really look at emission here, not at absorption. So if we were to illuminate the system at a lower voltage, we would be able to get. I think it depends on the system. I believe we took a region where the two spheres have both peaks, but we should have really, you're right, taken maybe even gauge the system so to look at more a visible range, and then we have the visible results.
Sorry, is it for the absorption or emission?
In this case, what we are talking about is emission. We illuminate at 6.5 electron volt, and we then look at emission. Okay. Now, what we had so far is a bottoms-up approach. Now we look from the top down. The next question we said, what will happen if we have not two spheres, but we have many spheres? And then we asked, well, solving this with a quantum model is too difficult if you have many of them. So why not start with a very simple classical model? Now, further than that, we took a model which is the simplest that you can think about. The evolution of a classical dipole in time looks like a Schrödinger equation, but all it is really a dipole coupling to other dipoles with some coefficient. Now, this model is overly simplistic, and we call it futuristic model, because it ignores two things. One of the more important, one less. The really important part is it ignores dispersion. In other words, in this model, the dipole is responsive to the electric field immediately. So it ignores friction, it ignores phase loss. This is unlike real nanodots that disperse. So just a rule of thumb, in the interaction between small nanodots, after about 3 or 4 dots, then you basically lose your coherence. Here we assume this coherence for large distances. Real nanodots disperse. So the way I would look at this result is not that we simulate existing experiment, but we try to motivate development of geometries that are narrow line. Of course, people are working on that, on having materials and geometries have a narrow line, but we want to show that you get very interesting results that should be further motivation. The other thing we ignore here is retardation, meaning dipoles do not respond immediately to one to each other, but with the velocity of light. But that's, on small scales, less important, because the dipole-dipole interaction goes down so quickly with the distance, so it should not be a major issue. Although in three dimension, it will be more important. Let's start first with one, the chain along, actually RIZ, it should be X here, along X. And we have three polarization. We have the transverse polarization, where the wave is along X, but the dipole along Y or Z. So this is one transverse polarization. There is another one. And there is a longitudinal polarization, which is emitting in the far field description. And it's more like a sound wave would be. Okay. But now let's look at a chain of such molecules. And we look at the dispersion relation. The dispersion relation, which just means the energy versus the momenta of the wave, it actually has these two forms. This is the dispersion relation for the transverse part, for the longitudinal, and this is for the transverse. Now, it's very easy to understand physically what happens. At zero momentum, that means all the polarization are aligned, all the dipoles are aligned, then it's clear that this will be attractive for longitudinal wave because the dipoles align itself in an attractive fashion. Electrons and the background, a positive background electron, so it's clearly will lower the energy. So that's where we are here. The transverse wave would cause, will have high energy in this classical system. And as you increase the wave vector, these two effects start reversing itself. Okay. More importantly even is the velocity. So what we have here is velocity, which is velocity is defined as the change of energy with respect to wave vector. That's the group velocity that we have. In a sense, you can think of k as the phase velocity, and this is the group velocity. So you see that for the transverse wave, because the energy goes down with k, the group velocity is negative. So we have positive phase velocity, negative group velocity. And it becomes really interesting in this region when there is curve crossing. Because curve crossing means that when you have a scattering impurity near a curve crossing, it can cause the wave to flip the polarization. So in principle, you can have flip the polarization even at this energy, but then you will have to jump to a different momenta, because when you're scattering, static scattering, you conserve the energy. So you have to have a huge jump here, but near the curve crossing, you don't need to any jump at all. So it's very efficient. And I'll now show you a movie where we start with longitudinal polarization, will be blue, will be going very fast, and then we will see what happened to the transverse polarization. So this is longitudinal, blue goes very fast, and this is the disturbance, and you see you create a backward going transverse polarization. This is a repetition of the same thing again and again. Repeat the movie twice. So we can cause easily waves to move backward. Should contrast it with regular quantum mechanics, mm-hmm. where it's hard to cause things to move backward. You need very violent interactions.
It's not a reflection necessarily.
Well, it's a reflection of a wave with a different polarization. So it's really not a reflection in the sense that the phase velocity of the two waves are the same. They are both positive. But the group velocity will be different. So the polarization that we have, the longitudinal that we start with, still continues to go forward. You can vary the magnitude, but most of it will go forward, and a portion of it will go backward, but with a different polarization. In order to cause the longitudinal wave to go backward, you need much stronger couplings. So that's why I say it's not a regular reflection in that sense. You can do then things, obvious things like ask yourself, what happened when you transfer between regions? How is the probability of transfer the function of energy? And the nice thing is that you are talking about step sizes. And this is very important maybe for future device applications. You can talk about corners, about T's. So as long as you have this coherent transport, you have very strong on or off scattering. Even more impressively is that you have band structure. And this is, especially here, it's tiny. We can talk about that the distance between each one of these is a nanometer. So this whole thing will be less than 100 nanometer. And here you make this beautiful band structure. And here even more, with slightly bigger, even more of a band structure. Okay, so let's now go to 2D. And 2D is actually much more interesting. So what we plot here is the polar for a 2D structure with dx equal dy. We plot the three polarizations, the function of kx and ky. Now, the off-plane transverse polarization is much higher. It really doesn't participate. But the on-plane transverse and longitudinal polarizations are actually cutting each other. And you would expect that you have this curve, that in this two-dimensional system, you'll have curve crossing at a few points only. It turns out there is almost curve crossing on extensive region. So if we look at this difference in energy between these two curves, and we plot it as a function of kx, ky, we get actually extensive region where it's extremely small. This scale is much smaller than this scale. And by the way, all the energies are in electron volt. If you do a cut now, you see that there is a long range of kx where delta E would be zero or very close to zero for a fixed ky. Okay. Now, what is the implication? Let's now look at taking two regions which have dx equal dy, but are shifted by half spacing. And we look what will happen to wave packets like that. Because there is a curve crossing, some very interesting effect will happen. We start here, a blue, and we create a transverse polarization which goes in this direction. So what we have in arrow form is we have something which is reminiscent of negative refraction. So in a sense, we have Snell's law, but with a negative n. And you can see here you have a huge difference in the direction of the two polarizations. Now, this is an example of something called birefringence. Birefringence is a natural phenomena associated with light. And it's the decomposition of ray of light into two rays with different polarization. And each of the polarization has typically a different speed. And that's the major effect, usually, that the birefringence is used for. And that's because the different speed is called the phase difference. And usually, it's a slight velocity, different velocity direction. But here we have a huge difference in the direction of the velocity. You can think of my student came up with this idea of using it as something which akin to a lens, because if you imagine that you start at here, away from the region, a wave packet that's split into two, and then because of this refraction, you have an image basically created back here at this point. And we are, again, we will be talking about distances which are extremely tiny. So we can have a nano imager one day with this. Okay. So to conclude this part, we have shown that you can have that if you are able to make nanodots, which will be coherent, and will have a narrow line, then you'll have some new phenomena, and that depend on the fact that you have curve crossing, which allows you to have the easy transition between the polarization. Now, of course, it all depends on whether you're able to find people are working now on different geometries, not just a square geometry. So it's a question of what will happen. Now, once you're able to do it, the beautiful thing is this will relate to chemistry. Because you can imagine coating one of these dots with a dye or a molecule which can change its acidity. So something that will change the polarization. And then you will have very easy gating because the moment you change the polarization of a molecule on top of a dot, that will change somewhat the resonance line. And since everything here is so sensitive, even a change of 0.1 or 0.2 electron volt will be able to change everything here. So you'll be able to gate this very simply. Okay, so this concludes this part on radiation-molecule interaction. And in the last part, I would like to talk to you about using birefringence for something quite different for a molecular spintronics. For this, we need to go talk 1 minute about spintronics. Spintronics is the idea of replace electrons by motion, by spin motion for computation. There are two problems when you try to look at molecular rather than mesoscopic or nanometric spintronics. Two problems when you try to think of applying this to molecules. The important thing is first, how do you control the spin? Typically, you control them by magnetic fields. But magnetic field effects, unlike electrical field effects, electrical fields is hard. It's easier to change on a small scale, in a sense, because the smaller, for a given voltage, the smaller distance, the bigger the electric field. With magnetic field, it's the opposite, because they are associated, their effect associated with the flux. The smaller the area, the smaller the effect. So if you think of applying molecular magnetic field on molecular scale, their effect will be small. The other problem, which is generally true in application, is when you change the spin current, what you really do is you usually can, in this field, typically stop the current or allow a polarized current. So one of the two things. Now, in other words, you change the currents of the electrons the minute you do a current change. So you can have effects of charging, etc. Now, when we thought about it, it became clear, something which other people have also thought about, of course, is one alternative to change to do is to use the spin orbit. Spin-orbit coupling, of course, is strong. I mean, that's the reason that transition metals have colors, because the spin-orbit is so strong. So the idea is here would be to use it for spin birefringence. Now, one problem we will have with spin-orbit interaction is that they are proportional not to a fixed controlled vector like BE would be, but they are related to L dot S. And L is angular momentum, so it's obvious that if I have a system which is symmetric with respect to inverting L to minus L, then this will not help me because L times S will be the same as minus L times minus S. So we need to find ways of doing that. And it turns out it's not too difficult to develop such ways. Now, the way to do it is, of course, to break the symmetry, the symmetry between L and minus L, to have systems with certain directions. And that has been also known. But it turns out that if you want to devise approaches that will filter spin, it will be difficult. The kind of interaction you talk about turns out to be quite weak. But here we will not want to filter spin. Here we want to do birefringence. So let me explain what I mean. The model we have is a racetrack geometry. For us, remember, x and y would be the directions on the plane. Now, this racetrack geometry, the way it's constructed, it's clear that the electron coming from here, think of this as one lead, and going here to another lead, that the electron here would be coupled essentially into resonance cavity. So think of this as the resonance cavity of the electron. In the middle, there is an atom with a strong spin-orbit interaction. Now, because the electron go in this direction, and because we have a coupling which is extended, not just at a single point, then the electron that come in, just like in a racetrack, the way you join a racetrack, once they come in, they have to go in a different direction, in a given direction. They will not go counter. Electron coming from here will not go counterclockwise. No, it will go clockwise. So they spin up and spin down will have different effect because L would be, if you go for here, L have to be positive, LZ, and therefore interaction with spin up and spin down would be different. It turns out that in this planar model, the probability for an electron to come from here to here is independent of its spin, being spin up or spin down. But the phase is different. So if we denote the Z polarization by an arrow, so if the electron starts with Z polarization up, it will end up, it should be also up, but times amplitude, here times amplitude, but these two amplitudes have different phases. So it's clear that if we start with a combination, and a combination of spin up and spin down will be a spin along x, we will end up with something which could be a spin along x, but could also be a spin in the opposite direction. Now, those of you who ever did optics know this. This is how we use birefringence. Because in birefringence in optics, typically it means that if you come in this axis or you come in this one, you will have different phases. So what people do is they start at a polarization which is in the middle. And when you get out, instead of this polarization being a equimixture of these two polarizations with the same phase, it will come up with a different phase. So what you get out will be a different polarization, circular, etc. Same story here. If we start here, we'll end up either here or here. Now let's look at what the model tells us. This model tells us something very interesting. The total transmission, which is what I plot here, as a function of energy, is very close to 1 in this region. So you have 100% transmission. But you have regions in energy where you completely flip your, or almost completely flip the spin. For example, this region or this part or even in between. There are regions like this one where you don't flip the spin at all. Okay. I should just say one more thing. The reason you need, one more reason you need this cavity is that a regular spin orbit effect actually is independent of energy. The reason is it depends on L, and L is velocity times the radius, that's the angular momentum. So, so semi-classically, the velocity part is important. And the integral of this over time, which is the action, is the integral of the velocity times dt, and that is independent of energy. So without using a resonance cavity, if you just ask yourself what will be the effect of spin orbit effect, that effect actually will be energy independent. So you need such a cavity. Okay, so this is good enough to get us published, but after all, it's a Haeckel model, so what do you do next? Well, I ventured and I actually went to Gaussian for the first time in my life. And we actually, well, not me, my students. I still don't know how to run Gaussian, but they were brave enough. And I basically, they're very capable students. Joe Speer and Dr. Amlan Roy helped here. So we asked them, I said, find me something which looks like this. And they came up with this structure. They came What we're talking, the equivalent of a resonance cavity will be naphthalene, an aromatic molecule. Here, the leads will be acetylene. The real leads have to be gold wires or gold region, but that's less of an issue because you can couple the acetylene. The spin orbit will be represented by tellurium. Now, you may ask me why tellurium and not regular transition metal. That's what I asked them. But they explained to me that our codes handle S and P, and so you don't need d orbital. I mean, we don't have d orbitals in our codes, and that process the information, and the tellurium you can treat with S and P. Actually, it may not be a bad thing because the way tellurium binds is actually maybe better suited for our purpose than a regular transition metal. And this part is something which is very akin to a molecule we found in the literature, which actually has bitellurium on both sides, so two tellurium molecules on both sides. Okay. And the first thing the first thing they came up with was to see if something like this can actually flip. What's the flip current? The flip current is here. It's not large. The non-flip current is larger in this case. But the thing is, when you break the bond so that the spin orbit effect is not anymore added coherently in both cases, then there is much less flip current. So that's the first good news. The second good news is that if you talk about more, we went all the way to 9, but really 4 should be enough. Adding them in this direction, then you ask what's the total flip current. Well, it actually becomes close to 100%. So, and this is for a given voltage without gating. If we did gating, it should change. But you can get 100% flipping, and if you change, I don't have the picture here, but if you change, if you gate, the results change. So, to conclude this part, what we've shown is that in a realistic model, shows you that you may be able to use interference for spin flip, so for spin control. Now, one thing should be clear: the electrons that come in this case are should have a definite spin. In this case, spin along x. So, before you actually use this device, you should come up with a lead which is ferromagnetic, so it aligns the spin in a given direction. But that's a preparation, but once inside, the device can actually be gated to electronically by to give you on a molecular scale control. The other nice thing is that unlike what we talked about, the quantum dot, which is very futuristic to the idea of coherence. For molecular devices, you actually typically, as long as you're bounded, you typically do have coherence. So you can imagine even packing several of these one after the other and keeping the coherence and therefore keeping the birefringence. And the last but not least, I want to thank Roy Baer. The first two projects that I mentioned were done with him. He's my colleague from Jerusalem. And thank my students. Ken did all the work on the Maxwell. Joe and Amlan and Igor Ovchinnikov, Dr. Igor Ovchinnikov, were involved in the spin part. Okay, thank you.
I have a question regarding that system demonstrated for negative refraction. Oh. Could you show that?
Sure. This one.
So what is here in blue and in red?
Oh, I'm sorry. Blue is always. Yeah.
point and vector, wave vector, and so on.
The pointing vector, since we are dealing with wave packet, the pointing vector is the direction of the wave packet. So what we are looking for is what we are looking at here is the direction of the wave packet. Now, this is one polarization. I believe in this case I call it longitudinal, but it's really a polarization along x. That's how we should look at it. So what we have is a wave coming in, and this wave at this interface between these two regions, which are different only by the fact that one is shifted a little bit relative to the other. At this interface, this wave breaks. And it breaks into two parts. One is going in this direction, continuing, essentially the same polarization, probably X polarization. And the other one goes with a different direction, with a Y, in the Y polarization. Those two waves have the same phase velocity. What they don't have is the same group velocity or pointing vector. So the phase velocity, let's say, I'm not sure, but essentially the phase velocity is in this direction. And this wave goes perpendicular. So this wave, its phase velocity is here, but its group velocity is here. Well, this wave has a similar phase and group velocity.
So we have two waves with two different polarizations, and basically we have just some angle between group velocity and...
Exactly. We have a large angle between the group velocity and phase velocity for one of them, but not for the other one.
Yeah, usually medium with negative refraction has a pointing vector and wave vector in opposite direction.
Yes, but here it's...
It looks like this is not the case.
Well, it's not... I mean, this depends on kx and ky. We could have them in the 1D case, for example, they were opposite. So we could have, I could have taken different, and this is very sensitive to which kx and ky. If I took, for example, this k, this direction, then it will be the pointing and the wave vector will be exactly opposite for one polarization, but not for the other one. But what is different from a regular negative refraction is the sensitivity to polarization being so big.
Yeah, it's interesting system since we have flip in polarizations at this interface.
Exactly.
I'm just trying to realize what happens there.
Yeah.
And what if, second question, last one, what is the ratio between wavelengths and typical size?
The system is essentially scale invariant, but the distances we employed were typically equal to diameter. So unlike this picture, with closed packs, we are talking about distances equal to the diameter. And then the wave vectors basically... we are talking about wave vectors which are half the maximum. So we are talking about in terms of if you use one as the unit of distance between or one as the unit of size between the vector, then the wave vector would be around also one or a little bit more. Yeah. So it's we are talking about maybe this picture will help. So the scales here are 3 pi over 2, pi over 2 pi. So we are talking about large momenta close to the maximum, close to pi over the spacing.
So it's more like photonic crystal, right? So wavelengths comparable with your typical size.
Yeah, it's wavelength. Because it's near field, the wavelength is very comparable to the size. The wavelength has no... basically, there is no... In this calculation, we didn't even use c, the velocity of light. So think of it more like it would have been for even for electrons. The wavelength in of nanometers, size of the vector, I mean the inverse wave vector nanometers too. By the way, everything is scaled. So instead of 1 nanometer, you're easier for you to think of 10 nanometers. Then you just scale it. It turns out that in this system, everything scales. As long as you are smaller than a micron, the retardation effect are not important. Then you're okay.
You're saying these are near fields, so the wavelength you're talking about is not the same as the far field wavelength of light.
Exactly.
If we're going to use optical light with the wavelength of the order of a micron, these spacings might be much smaller, and you'd still get these polarizations propagating in the medium.
Yeah, you need the same...
smaller length scale than the wavelength of light.
Exactly. The only thing that has to match, of course, is the frequency. But for a given frequency, basically the idea is you may use a dye or how to start this. You may use something which a dye or a tip to launch the waves, and then just like they do in regular experiments today, and then that wave propagates.
Just had a brief question about the second part. You talked about gating this. I didn't hear. How do you gate these things to turn them on and off? I mean, what's a physical way of, the second part, the spin, the Gaussian calculations of those.
Yeah.
So you could gate this, how would you gate it?
Well, you basically, this whole region, you basically need to change the energy of the electron that you inject. So you would need not just this part, but this whole region, you need to raise or lower, basically put voltage so that compared to the leads, you'll be at a higher or at lower energy. And it turns out that I didn't show it, but the important thing is the transmission is a function of energy, and it is quite abrupt, the transmission. The flip or the non-flip transmission has these regions, etc. So all you have to do is to choose which region you are at. Essentially, you would do by gating of this whole thing. So you don't have to gate individual molecule. You don't have to gate this part. No, you'll just gate the whole device, basically. Sure.
I had hopefully a relatively simple question from very early on. When you're talking about the self-energy in DFT calculations, I'm trying to wrap my head around that and how that would differ from a Hartree-Fock if you have two uncoupled systems at large distances.
Hartree-Fock is great in solving the self-energy problem. It has other problems. It doesn't... first of all, it's extremely expensive, but that's not the issue. It overestimates band gaps. So basically... using straight Hartree-Fock is not the answer in many of the cases we want. But as far as this part, the self-energy part is exactly working because of it works also in Hartree-Fock.
I'm trying to figure out why the self-energy fails in DFT. If you have two things separated, what is the interaction? How is it that the electron interacting with itself gives you the wrong result?
Sure, I'll give you an example. Let's say that we have H2 plus, so a single electron, and we have one proton here and one proton here, and I put them at different place because let's say we gate them. There is a voltage. So as far as the electron is concerned, there are two levels it can go to. The one is here or the one is here. Okay. Now, in Hartree-Fock, the electron will be here and that's it. I'm talking about unrestricted Hartree-Fock. In DFT, let's say you start here. The So you put all the density in this level, then the electron will be repelled. The electron will repel itself because the electron responds to density, and there is considerable density here. So it will be advantageous to push a little bit, not much, but typically, I forgot the number, 0.1%, 0.1, not 0.1%, 10% of the density, more or less, will come from here to here. And this has nothing to do with the distance. Even if you're extremely far away, if you're able to converge, it will actually prefer that 90% of the electron will be here and 10% will be here. Why? Because the repulsion between the electron, even classically, the Coulomb term is the density square. If the density is small here, the density square is essentially negligible. So you move, you pay a little bit penalty because you have to put this electron, or 10% of this electron is the higher orbital, so you pay a negative penalty of that, but you gain in that you reduced by 20% the electron-electron repulsion. And there is a balance, and the balance comes out to be at about 10% or so. So
the solution is to put an exponential penalty?
The solution is...
For having that 10% some distance away from the...
The solution is basically to include exchange, but exchange, so this PN, this is the density matrix, it includes an exchange, how can I say it? Well, it comes out that in a sense you have this penalty, so I'm trying to see exactly in the method, but basically, you don't have to think about it as a penalty, but you think that the long-range exchange interaction is there. The same way, if you write the Hartree fork in this language, actually it will look similar. So that part, there are parts of it which are long-range, and they look exactly like they would in Hartree fork. That's what I'm trying to say. What it means is that you need to calculate all to do all the DFT simulation that you did before, you need to redo them for the new potential, not 1 over r, but e minus gamma r over r. But it's doable. It's not a big deal to do. We've done it once for calibration, and then you can have basically, you can use the method.
No, please join me in thanking.